Life is weird. People are weirder.
And we're just trying to make it through without ending up in straitjackets. Because how would we drink our wine?
I'm Pascal LaForest.
And I'm Solène Castrovilla. We're cousins, besties, and the voices behind Life in Jest, a podcast that tackles the strange, the dark, and the ridiculous.
With a healthy dose of sarcasm and whatever humor we can wring from the madness.
From true crime to pop culture to stories too bizarre to be fiction,
we're unpacking it all, one sip of wine at a time.
Follow Life in Jest wherever you get your podcasts.
Because honestly, we don't know what's coming out of our mouths next either.
There was definitely a possibility of him committing a domestic terror attack, as he admits to in the film. I think at that time, he didn't feel that he had much to live for. He had this crazy, sick ambition of being remembered for having conducted something similar to Timothy McVeigh.
Welcome, fellow leshes. Come on in, pull up a bar stool, and enjoy some cocktails with Dimples and the Beard.
Well, yes, my beard is looking fantastic. Thanks for asking. You want to know why?
It's fucking looking magnificent.
I know. That's why you asked. You want to know why?
I do want to know why.
My new best friends, engrave before shave.
Oh, and this is just, look at that.
This is a tiny little sampling of all the goodies these boys sent me.
Look at that marketing. Let me see that. That's some cool ass looking label.
And I've been using it.
Bottles.
And I love it. And my beard has never looked better.
So you got a grave before shave, man.
Yeah. So thank you.
Great before shave. Conditioner.
They sent me conditioner, shampoo, beard butter, beard balm, beard oil, a beard brush, beard bandanas. Just bandanas. I don't think they're for your beard. I posted a picture a while back of all the stuff they sent me.
I did.
You should be able to see it. We're not going to put it. I'm going to put it right in front of me.
Oh, that smells good.
Smells fucking delicious. The ladies love me. I've got to fend them off now. It's incredible. My wife is like, you got to get rid of that shit. It smells too good. Their beard butter, the scent, aphrodisiac. And let me tell you, it works.
Could you use it for other areas of patched hair other than your beard?
All right. Welcome back to another episode of Cocktails with Dimples in the Beard. Now let's get to the cocktails.
It's a legitimate question.
You'll have to ask them.
I see. It could be a whole other market to get into.
Maybe there probably is. Pube butter, but not from Grave Before Shave that I'm aware of.
I think if you buy it, they don't care where you use it.
That's true.
And if it works,
if it makes your balls smell better
and softer, and
nobody's gonna care. No. Believe me.
I'm just saying.
Balls can get stinky from what I've been told.
Well, not with some good butter.
You're welcome, Stefan Howe. Fuck, we ruin every one of these. We have a legitimate fucking journalist coming on, and we're talking about our ball bags. Anyway, I already said it. Welcome back to another episode of Cocktails with Dimples in the Beard. Let's talk about the cocktails we're going to drink on this episode.
Well, hold on. Let's open the tavern before you go looking at drinking in some cocktails.
Well, I want to drink, man.
Look, I can imagine.
Oop, Brewing.
What a cool place.
Down in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and soon to be in Appleton, Wisconsin.
That is going to be so cool when they open that up, hopefully sooner than later.
What an amazing, cool brewery tap room that they have down there. I don't know if you remember this, but I remember it because pickleball!
They had pickleball, they had volleyball, they had darts. They have
a lot of shit going on.
They just have everything going on. Bands, live music.
Yeah, you know what band they just had?
They had a
Trippin' Billy's.
Yep. Dave Matthews Tribute Band.
Yep. I wish we could have gone. All right. I'm going to pour. You talk. Oh, look at that.
Look at that.
It looks like.
We got a sour.
I'm probably pouring like
sour.
Pouring like an idiot.
Real man.
Yeah. But.
Hope sour.
It kind of looks like. Kind of looks like Cold Red Mountain Dew, which you know I love.
Oh, boy. He's in love now.
I'm one of those.
That's all he's going to drink. You can't drink that before work in the morning. You know that, right?
This, I can drink it at my desk because people will be like, oh, look, he's just drinking his Mountain Dew.
Mountain Dew.
Nobody will know. Let's give it the smell test.
Why do you know pour your cold Mountain Dew?
Smells delicious. Smells like strawberries and rhubarbs.
I wonder why.
Well, because it's oat, soury, fruited sour ale with strawberry and rhubarb. Bing, bing. First taste test.
Give it a whirl.
I can't wait.
I'm going to give it a whirl, too. Fruited sour. What do you think?
Ooh. If you like if you like rhubarb pie, that kind of shit.
Yeah.
That's what you get right there.
Holy Christ.
That's a good. You finish that.
That is delish.
I don't think fruited. I don't think sour beer has gluten. You're good.
Why do people try to kill me all the time?
Because if I kill you, I get this podcast to myself and we're making so much money now. It would be great if I didn't have to split it in two.
Split it in half. That is good. I'm going to have another sip.
You go right ahead.
It's pretty delish.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I know. And I was
go.
I always worry about like these fruited things because I'm like, it's going to be too much. You know, it's like, you know.
Well, it's not.
It's not. It's, it. Yeah. This is
no, it's very smooth.
And it's, I could see sitting outside when it's nice and hot.
It's a good strawberry flavor. That's a true strawberry flavor too.
Right. Not that fucking.
Artificial.
Yeah. Shit that tastes like cough syrup. No, this is good.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That is very good. Wow. Good job, guys. I guess you know what you're doing.
What you going to drink?
I'm going to go with a little Dirty Helen. Got a little bourbon. Bourbon on the rocks.
Are my good friends down there at Great Lakes?
Yes, we are.
They're doing a lot of fun shit, too. We got to, if we lived in Milwaukee or Madison.
I'd hang man.
By the way, you're not supposed to tell the good news before the good news actually happens, but I love to jinx myself.
Okay.
One of my favorite emails that I've gotten in the past couple of days was I sent out a joke, kind of. I mean, it was just like to Lola's down in Madison about how we would love
loading up this episode.
We would, well, I mean, this is not a shout out to them. I mean, it is. This is just a natural shout out to them because we love them so much.
Oh my God.
And I thought, well, let's just, hey, we'd love to record an episode of our podcast. Our thing, and they'd be like, yeah, fuck off.
And thanks, but no thanks.
And instead they were like, okay. So now, again, the details aren't sorted out. This may never come to fruition. So if it doesn't, don't pretend you never heard this.
We will make it happen because that would be one of the coolest backdrops, one of the greatest. It's one of my favorite bars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're ever in Madison, Wisconsin.
And you're already up there.
Moved right to the top.
And it's a good thing I don't live in Madison because I would.
God, we look like pimps.
I would be there forever.
Jesus.
Every night.
We are commercialized. The sellout is complete, folks.
You know, but if we're going to sell out, let's sell out for deliciousness.
Yeah, I know. This shit tastes good.
Oh, and groominess.
Oh.
Well, no grooming going on. Just good stuff.
The good stuff. All right.
And it's pretty kick ass. I mean, I do like the. Their marketing is pretty kick-ass.
Ooh, that's going to go down in a hurry.
Yeah, so we'll save that for you.
I'll just fill up the rest of the can.
Because it will go down fast. That is refreshing. Yeah. But yeah, all this good stuff. We got hard-hitting journalism coming on. Investigating journalists coming on.
Right. Stefan Howe.
Yep.
A journalist out of Denmark who did a documentary called Faces of Hate. And I got drawn to it because it said a real life American History X, and I love the movie.
And it's true.
And it is essentially that story, only real life.
It'll be fun to talk to him about it. And it was great. It's a great watch.
Yeah, it is.
It's an interesting watch.
2 million people agree. I mean, the thing is getting watched and watched and watched, and it's only been out for a couple of months. So thrilled that he was willing to come on and talk to us about it and how it came to be. So,
before he comes on,
yeah.
I had a dream last night.
About?
Literally last night.
Okay.
And I don't know how to feel about it.
Was it about me?
Nope. Sorry.
Was it about my wife?
Nope.
Kill you.
Sorry.
Okay.
I went into a restaurant by myself.
Mm-hmm.
They seated me at a table with three other people.
That makes sense.
It was weird because it was not like a...
Were they all chicks?
All together. No, they're... Well, some might say three people. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh.
I don't know what that means.
I recognize them.
Oh.
But I played it cool and pretended not. It was a younger kid and older. They sat me with Aaron Carter.
I don't know who that is.
And then Nick Carter was there.
They're
boy band singers.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. I don't know why they popped into my head. And I sat with them. And then over time, I played it cool, like, you know, didn't know who they were. And then the older brother's like, you know who you're sitting next to? And he was more talking about me and being next to Aaron Carter, who's now dead. But... Oh. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. He's a pop star.
Who was the third person?
Like another sibling.
Oh.
And Nick Carter was in Backstreet Boys and then Aaron Carter. It was the weirdest dream.
Were you listening to Backstreet Boys before you went to bed?
Nope.
You can tell.
I swear to God, I didn't go to bed with the Backstreet Boys and playing in the background.
I would like to go to bed with the
I just woke up going, why would I dream about the Carter Brothers?
The Backstreet Men. Speaking of men.
Well, if you want to hear more great stories about my dreams, because I do like to talk about my dreams, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, follow us on X, give us on TikTok and all that good stuff. Big one, YouTube, big one, YouTube. Go to there, subscribe, like, leave a comment, any platform. We are on all the Spotify's and Apple Music as well. If you don't want to look at our faces, which I don't understand why you wouldn't, because we're beautiful human beings, give us a listen. And then we just wouldn't want to keep a handsome man waiting.
All right. So without further ado, Stefan Howe.
Hey, guys.
Hello, sir.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. You guys are in shorts and t-shirts.
We are.
I guess the weather is nice then.
We only get shorts and t-shirt weather for like 3 months where we're at. I mean, you know, you've been in Michigan. We're just right. We're in Wisconsin.
Real close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in London. I arrived here 2 days ago.
Okay.
And it was like, I came in from Copenhagen and it was like traveling from August direct into late October.
Cold,
windy. That was quite a shock.
Isn't it? I've never been, but isn't London like that quite a bit?
Yeah.
I think it is. I think that they get fairly hot summers.
Okay.
Just like at times we do in Denmark. But I used to live here 30 years back. Ooh. And I've never experienced a winter as cold as the one here in London.
Oh, really?
Only in Chicago.
Chicago's cold.
That makes sense. Yep, there you go.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us, Stefan Howe. We came to know you from your documentary, which is now up to 2 million views on YouTube. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Faces of Hate, I was drawn to it because the title says An American History X Real Story, which I love that movie. So it drew me to it right away. And I watched the thing and was just amazed at what you put together there and thought we'd reach out and see if you'd be willing to come on and talk about it. And here we are. So thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
So how did you get hooked up with Jason Barker? Let's bring him out there. He's the main person in the story. So how did you get hooked up with him?
That's actually a different story than just doing a documentary. Because if we go back, I think 12 years, I was doing a book about the 10 biggest challenges that U.S. society was facing back then, seen by America himself. It was stuff like social inequality. And one of the themes were also racism.
Yeah.
Okay. And I digged around in that environment for months. At that time, the number of hate groups and people joining them in the U.S. was heavily increasing.
Yeah.
So it should be fairly easy at that time actually getting in touch with these guys because they also portrayed themselves as being open Christian societies for family and friends, etc. That was how they were portraying themselves at that time. But every time that I got in touch with them, none of them had the guts to actually come forward with their faces, talking about their beliefs, convictions, etc. I think I reached out to like 100 different Klan members across the U.S. And none of them replied. And if they even did reply, it was sour. It was threatening. It was the complete opposite of how they like to be portrayed in the public.
Just goes to show what cowards they are.
Yeah, absolutely. But one day, I got an email from a guy that was anything but a coward. I didn't like his views. I didn't like the way that he was treating other people. But at least he had the balls to stand by his convictions. So he reached out and said, listen, Stefan, anytime you like, feel free to give me a call. And we did an interview for my book. Or actually, we did, you know, the interview over a couple of times. And I was so intrigued by this guy that after the book came out, and it should have been a wrap, we kept in touch. And we kept in touch to a degree where he would start telling me things about his life that was not about his racial beliefs, etc. It was about how he came into this world and what actually drew him to the Ku Klux Klan in the first place.
Yeah.
And that was mainly because when he was 7 years old, and it's a terrible story that I think explains a lot about who he was. 7 years old, he was walking down a dirt road with his mom, who was a fairly young woman, I believe, at the age of 25. And they were singing Johnny Cash songs in this dirt road in Michigan. And suddenly a truck comes and hit both of them. Mm. The guy driving the truck came out saying stuff like, I hit a fucking deer. Fucking deer. But it turned out that it was a 25-year-old woman and a 7-year-old son. And a few minutes later, she drew her last breath in the arms of Jason.
Oof.
And today you would imagine that if you're 7 years old and you experience such a gruesome thing, there would be counselors there. There would be therapists. There would be anyone that you needed to take care of you and help you through this living nightmare. Mm-hmm. But not back then. Back then, he was actually put on the couch by himself at night in the house of a family member. And the way he, in the film, but also in general explains how he felt all alone after his mom a few hours earlier died in his arms, and he was there all by himself in the dark, crying.
Yeah.
That did a terrible number on him. And he was so sad. He had such, you know, tremendous grief in life by that time. And if you don't get help, how do you deal with that 7 years old?
Right.
You probably deal with it as many people would. You find out that it's easier getting angry, hateful, violent, than it is actually dealing with the grief and the sadness that you feel. So he became a very angry, violent kid. He didn't mind even fighting grown guys at the time, and he was quite good at it. So though he tells that his family took great care of him, it didn't help him overcome the sadness. And the next time he actually found a family, a sense of belonging, was when he was, by more or less chance, watching the KKK doing a rally in Howell, Michigan. And he afterwards went up to these guys. And bastards as they are, and it doesn't only go for the KKK or white supremacists. It goes for everyone with evil intentions who prey on young people who are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm, they right.
To the Klan and feeling this sense of belonging, admiring these big bad guys, he naturally felt a need to also become one of them because he thought that would help this low self-esteem that he was brought into this world with. Yeah. And so,
now, how old was he when he met the Klan the first time?
Roughly, I believe he was 16 or 17.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's finally got he's something that feels like family again.
Exactly. Yeah. As it happens to a lot of people.
Right. Absolutely. Right. That's how a lot of people end up getting hooked up in it, is they're alone for whatever reason. And this family, you know, unit comes along. And they are, I mean, one thing, obviously, they're horrible, terrible people for what they believe in, but they are loyal to each other as long as they all believe in the same things. And it does feel like a family. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, it's a huge problem. It could go for many other races trying to recruit people for a horrible cause. It goes for football hooligans as well to go in a completely different direction.
Sure.
That's also how they get their fighters out on the street. Those are the young kids who do not come from a solid home and suddenly they find one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, the book that you talk about, How far into Jason's story does the book go? And then, from that point, then you decided, okay, I want to continue interviewing him? Because the documentary spans over, 7 or 8 years?
Right. Yeah. We filmed him for roughly 7 years.
Okay.
And when we started out doing the film, I remember the first time when I personally went down a dirt road in Michigan. It was to see Jason in person for the first time, because when I read the book, I was in Denmark.
Okay. How scared are you at the point when you're going down this dirt road to meet somebody from the KKK for the first time?
I don't get scared that easily when it comes to my work. When I was 21 years old and I was starting out as a journalist back in 2000, I believe it was, I actually went to the Balkans right after the Civil War, trying to somehow infiltrate some of these human traffickers, at that time bringing people in to Europe through the Balkans, because it was, chaos after the war. Mm-hmm. And I was, at that time, I was taken at gunpoint by these traffickers. And back then I was super scared and I was fairly young. And I saw, as they say, your life, it just flashes by.
I would imagine.
It did to me as well back then. So I was super scared then. But after that, I think I've become a bit more cynical about my job, because I know what I get myself into, but I also do it with, a lot of consideration for my own safety. And sure. What I did when I went down there for the first time to these KK guys, whom are also neo-Nazis, they're everything under the sun, more or less.
Yeah.
I had a great friend who used to be a special ops with the U.S. Army.
Okay.
And a police officer. So, I coordinated with him.
Good idea.
There you go.
and what I did, I left my cell phone in the car, because, on the cell phone, they might find, pictures of me with people they didn't like, etc. But we had a routine where I would actually have to go back to the car, and he would ask me a question about, is your sister still at the restaurant? And I would say yes, though I had no sister at a restaurant. I would say no. Stuff like that. Things that he was, much more prepared for than me. So that gave me a sense of safety. But yeah, it was daunting. And I was definitely tense and on the lookout, both me and the camera guy. Because the thing is, when you drag yourself into an environment like this, you don't come free, camera guys, a sound guy, people with light, etc., because that would actually, not get you very far in an environment like that, where you need to be a close, intimate person that they can actually tell the secrets.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it turned out that Jason respected me for who I am, and he didn't, try to persuade me or anything. He stood up for what he believed in. And I think that because I treated him with great respect, as I would with any source, he was also more open and felt comfortable around me and then shared his life. The greatest concern I had after, a few hours and days, was actually going to some of these compounds where they were shooting guns.
Oh, yeah, big guns.
East, west, north, south, with all their crazy muscle dogs or whatever it's called. That gave me some unrest because it was an environment where you actually didn't know if one was getting too drugged up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And would point the gun in the wrong direction.
Right, yeah.
Did you ever run into any of his friends or clan members that didn't want to be recorded?
I ran into a few. But the ones that mainly had concern with that was
some outlaw bikers that was sure. the affiliation these guys as well. But you know, that is what I love about my job. It is actually being able to go in there and see what it's like being in an outlaw gang or motorcycle club without actually needing to get a patch.
going through the initiation.
Right. So what, I mean, let's go back to the beginning, because what led you to this type of journalism to begin with? Because this is, I mean, it does feel like right from the get-go of your journalism career, you're kind of putting your life on the line to get the story. What made you want to do this?
I think that journalism is important.
Very, yes.
And you know, there are different types of journalists, but I'm the kind of journalist that likes showing this environment to other people, but also it is to some extent some kind of an ego trip, showing your colleagues, showing people around you that you can actually do it. To be honest, and I think that is what also attracts a lot of journalists going into war zones or, you know, swimming with alligators in the Everglades.
Yeah,
which I wouldn't recommend anyone trying, but
okay, I was about to, but not anymore.
but I think that was what it, you know, what made me go into this. But the thing about my story as a journalist and my career is, shortly after that, I went down to the Balkans. I started my first production company, where I actually work with some of the biggest daily newspapers in Denmark on a outsourcing basis. They would outsource part of their production to my company. I would have a ton of journalists, photographers, designers, etc., employed by the age of 25, 26. And it gave me a little bit more cash than normally when you're 25 years old.
Okay.
So after having lived that nightmare with a lot of employees, which I don't recommend either, I had the opportunity of doing the journalism that I want to do. And that is what I do as well today. I also produce talk shows and stuff for other networks. Right now, I'm in London, UK, where I'm going to produce a talk show with six different British celebrities.
Okay. Oh, sure.
Who's going to be on a show with a celebrity host. And that is my company. I developed the concept together with a big American network. And we're doing that show now. And you know, I've been working for months on it. And I've been, you know, a lot of people are working on it as well. So I'm doing that now. And I make, you know, a cent or two on that show. And when I've done that show, I have the liberty of spending more or less the time that I want on doing the documentaries. So the money that I make from a show like that, I will take that and go to the US, find a new story. And I work because I have this business set mind behind the way that I work. So I don't do a project, finish it, and hope for the next to come along. Constantly, I am, you know, squeezing the oranges so that I have the juice all the time.
Sure.
And we're about to cut another great, hopefully, an important documentary about the real life story of Frances McDormand's character in Three Billboards.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That she won an Oscar for as best female that year.
That's a great movie.
It is. It's about a fantastic woman, Marianne Asher Chapman. The people who did Three Billboards have all the time claimed that Marianne's story is not what they based their film on. But the thing is, it both takes place in Missouri. Both the victims' names are Angie. A deer appears at the same time in a wooded area and stuff like that. There's so many things going back to Marianne's real-life story that just is, you know, more or less one-to-one with the film. So perhaps they didn't want to pay credits or anything. I don't know.
And, right.
You know, nothing's proven. But we're doing a story about her daughter that went missing. And Marianne herself actually found the killer in a very clever way.
Mm-hmm.
But what she never found was the remains of the daughter.
Okay.
The guy that was convicted for it claimed to have dumped the remains in the Ozarks, but they've never been found. They've never been found because he would have gotten a completely different. He said that it was an accident that he killed her. If they find the remains, they might find a bullet wound to her head.
Sure, and yeah.
Definitely not an accident. So I've been working on that film, filming that since 2018, I think. We did that filming last year. Unfortunately, just as we were about to finish the film, doing the last filming, Marianne passed away. But it's a important and great story. And we're cutting that now.
Okay. So, that's so, Missing in Ozark, correct?
It's going to be, we're calling it Missing in the Ozark.
Okay.
So the remains still haven't been found. So Marianne passed away before the remains were found.
She did, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that brings me to my next thought. You mentioned 6 years, 7 years with Jason. You got to have patience, it seems like, when you want to do a documentary. But I would imagine that there's a side of you that just wants to put it out, wants to get to the ending. How do you keep yourself, you know, intact to be so patient?
Who says that I do?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Naturally, you know, when you sit on material that you think is really good, really great,
mm-hmm.
you want to show it to the world. But I think that, you know, with producing journalism, producing documentaries, TV shows, etc., today it all passes so fast. You could put something out on Netflix that would be a huge success today, but forgotten tomorrow.
Right.
So I think that has taught me to enjoy the process and you know, being a bit more patient than I would have been just 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. So right now, with producing a TV show like the one here in the UK, it's super stressful. So many things that can go wrong. And, you know, I don't know how many sleepless nights it caused me.
I imagine, yeah.
Because, you know, what do we do with filming on the 8th of October? What if that big famous actor actually, you know, doesn't turn up because something happens? Well, how are you going to explain that to the network? Blah, blah, blah. So constantly I'm thinking about these things, but you know, there's nothing I can do about it. And hopefully and most likely the actor will show up on the 8th of October. So I'm also training my mind just like, you know, wanting to put things out right away. I'm also training my mind now to saying creating a TV show like that here is phenomenal. It's great. It's big. Only a few get to do that, also because it's one of the most famous networks in the world. So, young man, chill, relax, enjoy, because no one thinks that it's going to come again. But I'm also, you know, the kind of person thinking, okay, who are we going to have on season 2? Who are we going to have on season 3? Who are we going to have on season 4? And, you know, we haven't done season 1 yet. But that is also how I'm thinking and how I've been doing all my life. I think that is why I've put out 3 books, done a number of TV shows, etc., because I'm constantly on the go, on the move. But I don't know if that is the right thing to be. I'm turning 50 in just a few weeks.
Shut up.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
I'll send you the exact date and address so you know. You can send whatever you like. Just make sure that it's something expensive. And if it's not cat, at least something that I can return and get the cash.
Okay, fair enough.
Besides that, you know.
Right there, you know he's an honest journalist.
Right?
Yeah, you should be. No, but I'm starting to think, it's definitely worth it, but is that the way that you want to go about your life? Constant, you know, being on the move, et cetera, or should you just, you know, lean back and enjoy a bit more? But I know the answer to that. The minute that I'm done with one thing, I'm already started on a different. So
yeah, I was gonna say, following you on Instagram, you are definitely on the move a lot. It seems like, you know, you're all around the world. I am curious why the United States is, like, the rest of the world just not fucked up enough that you're like, the United States is a hotbed of just shit.
And I think that, I don't know if that was a question or you gave the answer yourself.
Both, I think. It sounds like both.
No, but honestly, I think I love Americans. I love America. I have been coming to the U.S., went to the U.S. the first time when I was 17.
Okay.
On my own. I spent almost a month there. I don't know how my parents would allow me to go to the U.S. all by myself at the age of 17. I'd never
sounds
do it
like
my...
they didn't have a choice. You were going to go. How determined you sound, you were going regardless.
I think so. And I was just thinking, you know, as you said that, I was thinking, even when my daughter is 37, I won't allow her to go by her. but then again, if she comes and she's 17, you know, I'll be in the same position as my parents probably were. But I've always been traveling to the U.S. a lot. I've traveled, you know, I think like 40 states or so. And in many ways, I love Americans. I have a lot of great American friends that I've gone to visit again and again, and they've been here numerous times in Europe as well. But and the reason why I'm doing journalism there is because the access to, as you said yourself, fucked up stories is much greater in the U.S. Because it is a nation that is so much bigger than any nation you would find in Europe. And it is also a place I can go and do journalism. I won't have these. Naturally, I'm not American, a native speaker. But at the same time, I don't have any problems conducting my job there. Yeah. It would be a different story if I went to France or if I went to Thailand, whatever. Sure. So that is one of the reasons. But also Americans, they like to talk. And
we are proud of ourselves, aren't we?
And you're great at it. And you're great at it. Because, you know, I've also done, as you know, a lot of interviews on camera. And I'm never afraid of doing an interview with an American because they just talk and talk and talk. It's a different thing with many other nationalities. You have to drag the words out of them. But that is why, you know, it's a great place. But also the diversity of stories in the U.S.
Sure.
You know, a really nice buffet for a journalist like me. I'm not much in the U.S. for the time being, and I haven't been to the U.S. for more than a year, and that is the first time in probably in a ton of years that I haven't been. Sure. Normally I come several times a year. And without going into any kind of politics, this or that, red, blue, left, right, north, south, you know, enough said about that because, you know, it gets tiring. Yeah. But what surprises me is that today I find it hard speaking to any Americans that do not say, don't come here now. It's fucked up. It's really shitty. You don't want to come here, blah, blah, blah. So when I talk to you guys, my American friends or you know, something that is work-related, everyone is like, and it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or if you're a Republican, because it seems like constantly you have something to hold against each other.
More so than ever.
And it's sad, and, you know, at the same time releasing Face of Hate, I've also seen another side of Americans that I really don't like, because people, they get offended by European putting spotlight on racism. Why don't you do it in Europe? Blah, blah, blah. Well, I could have done it in Europe, but I just happened to stumble upon this great, phenomenal story in the U.S.
Right.
If I'd done that in England, I would have done it here. Now, yeah. It turned out America. But constantly, then it turns into, like, you know, USA, USA, USA. And that is one of the things that I think also goes a lot for many Americans these years, that there's so much going on with you guys and the society that you live in right now, that either you get perhaps more critical than you have to be, and that is reasonable to be. But on the other hand, you also get so, I would almost say, kind of nationalistic about, you know,
oh, yeah.
USA, USA. And I think that is sad. I think that it's sad that we're also right now living at a time where, because face it or not, regardless of how people they sing and dance, Europe and the U.S. have been allies for 100 years.
Yeah.
And we are, and so are Americans, so depending on Europeans as well. It may not be for this month or the next or this year, but trust me, you'll be depending on Europe again, as Europe is depending on you in the future.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we, and this is not, because that is another side of it. I do get that a lot of South Americans moving to the U.S., feeling that rightfully that is their home now. They're like, why Europe? Why not South America? The same thing with Asia and so on. But historically, we've been allies financially, in war times, in so many aspects for the last 100 years or more, that you don't just, you know, throw that out with, you know, within a month, within a year, within one term of election. So if we could just get back to something very banal, that you can be a Russian dictator invading other countries. We can't allow that there will be dictators in the Middle East creating nuclear bombs, etc. We can't allow this and that because it goes against our values. Right. And there's really no need to debate if it's right or wrong invading another country. Let's not go, you know, let's just start by deciding that we're going to stand shoulder by shoulder saying that's not okay and we're going to stop it. And not debating, did we actually spend $1 billion more than you? Like certain American politicians say that they've actually put more money into defending Ukraine, whereas a ton of surveys show that the European Union has put way more money into it. Let's not argue and debate these stupid things, because by the end of the day, there's one thing that is more important, that is stopping, you know, the invasion in Ukraine. It is, you know, making sure that Iran does not get nuclear bombs. It is making sure that also the Israelis, that they behave, that they're not protected from what they do to the Palestinians. Should we actually say these days, it is fair and it's right that there's a state called Israel, but is it also fair that there's a state called Palestine, etc.? You know, let's discuss the bigger and more important picture than this nitty-gritty things that is going on with big, powerful men being a bit angry because one gave the other one another handshake that was too hard, or he didn't wear a suit, or, you know, that is bullshit. Grow up, guys.
Well, they just
seems like, being a journalist of yourself, now is the time to be over here because of all these everything we just talked about. This would be great filming right there for you.
It would, but it also kind of was what I did 10 years ago with Jason, just in another aspect. But when Obama was elected, that was when the rise of the hate groups started.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were scared. When I wrote my first book, a lot of people were scared about if someone would suddenly come, a senator, demanding that the Spanish language was going to be put side by side with the English, and so on. So it was just in a different way back then. Things that has never been aired and turned into a documentary because I gave up on it was also spent time with militia groups.
Oh, wow.
They were kind of, you know, of the same convictions as Jason. They just didn't call it a holy racial war. They called it a civil war, etc. Right. The enemy was not, you know, when you spoke to them, that was the government authorities. But also, especially if it was, you know, not the white race, then they would actually feel the same way. They were just, you know, kind of more intelligent the way that they concealed their true beliefs.
Yeah.
So I did back then what I could also do today. But the division in the U.S., it's like it's been going on now for close to 20 years, since 2008.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the same treadmill going over and over again. So the political stuff, these issues, I think that they're tiring. And I think that it's also time that we guys moved on. I think portraying a person like Jason, a person, completely different person as Marianne, and some other stuff that I'm working on, that is much more fascinating.
Well, that's what I really loved about the documentary is it is so personal, and we are hearing Jason's story, and we know that Jason's not the only one, but you were able to dive deep into what made Jason Jason instead of just talking about the subject as a whole. And I'm curious, do you think if Jason doesn't go to jail in, I think it was 2004 for the fight that he had with the black undercover off-duty officer, do you think he gets as radicalized as he was if he doesn't end up in jail?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
But naturally, going to prison, then you're really in the limelight of getting, you know, 10 times as bad as you were before.
Right.
Especially if you enter, you know, the Aryan Brotherhood as he did. But I think Jason came from a background where he had nothing but his hatred, his anger. Sure. And it's really sad. But, you know, he didn't have the beliefs. He didn't have the racial hatred that he thought he had. He didn't have that within him, you know, down in his heart and bones. And that was also why he was able to change. But I think that he was so lost in this world that no matter what, that was the course that he was on. And I think that if he hadn't, sorry to say, it sounds big-headed, it's not meant that way, but it's meant in an honest way, if he hadn't met me, he would still be living that life.
Yeah.
And so he says himself that it was me confronting him with his hatred.
Yeah.
But actually, also not condemning him, but listening to him as he explained it, that made him think about the life that he was living and turning himself around.
I by watching it, I totally agree with you and believe you.
Yeah.
100% that you made a big impact on him.
Yeah.
And when you confronted him about taking down the signs,
right,
the Doku sign that he had in his pig, that was huge. I think that was huge.
Yeah. Just to explain.
Yeah,
just to explain to the listeners,
yes,
who haven't seen it yet, we're strongly counting on you seeing it within the next 84 minutes of finishing this podcast. Is that, that it is.
I would go even further. I would say pause now, go watch the documentary and come back.
That's a great thought.
Yeah.
And when you were done with the podcast, you can watch it again.
Yeah.
Yes.
But no, to the listeners, in Jason's backyard, he had a pig pen, and he had named this pig pen after a concentration camp called Dachau, and he was also planning on putting up another pig pen, calling it Auschwitz. And I saw that, and we went around filming for a few days. We did some filming out in his backyard. We saw him feeding the pigs, etc. And spare for a moment, I thought, okay, let me share a bit of my story with you, Jason. And I told him how some of my family members in Denmark during World War II were put in a concentration camp. White Christian Danes, not because they were Jews, they were Christian, but because they were in the resistance movement here. And also had my father's uncle, who was a police officer in Denmark at the time, he was also put in a concentration camp. And I remember visiting him with my parents when I was at the age of, I think, of 15.
Wow.
And he told about what World War II had done to him. A big, proud, strong police officer. And as I saw that sign and as I interviewed Jason, I shared that story and asked him if he would actually, together with me, take down the sign Dachau because of how it affected me watching him, you know, naming a pig pen after a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And when I asked him, I honestly didn't know if he was gonna attack me.
Because yeah, I thought he was gonna tell you to fuck off, quite honestly.
Right.
So did I. And I saw there were those 10 seconds in his eyes.
Right.
Where I think that he was really caught off guard. And when guys like him, or who he used to be, is being caught off guard, they respond with violence because it's so easy.
Right.
Especially if you're used to it. But he, you know, I thought that something happened within him saying, okay, this is actually my time and moment to come clean, my time and moment to escape the hatred. And so he did. That was a very, you know, at the time I thought, oh, it was great getting it out. But I was also thinking, this is great TV. Naturally, I did. Today,
is that the first time you kind of saw, like, something really human about him, yeah, and not just the evil that he was?
Physically, with my eyes, yes. But I sensed before we started filming that there was something deeper in him.
Yeah.
Because he explained to me how he had lost his mom, and you know that, sure, he was in a real life. And I sense at that time, the reason why you tell me that is because you actually need someone to lend you an ear. So
absolutely.
Yes. So I'm glad we did that today. It's great TV, that moment, but it's also something that I'm actually, you know, proud of, that I had the guts to ask him.
As you should be. Yeah.
Thank you, because it would be so easy as a journalist not to ask that question that moment with thoughts upon your own safety, etc. But I'm glad that I did. And I think that I truly believe that it's an outstanding moment an outstanding film.
Yeah.
Because I truly think that it is. And what is important for me also to say, and that is to inspire hopefully other filmmakers. I'm so proud of this movie that we did because we created the movie as we saw it fit and the right way of telling a story like this. We spoke to some networks, and how should I put this? Perhaps I should just put it straightforward.
Please do.
They were pussies in the way that they were afraid that their viewers they would respond in a negative manner towards this film because they didn't want to see anything more about racial issues.
It's reality.
But, you know, a lot of the networks, they thought, oh, we're going to offend our viewers by airing. Others, they were saying, oh, could we actually like the movie, but we don't like that there's nothing about Trump in it. Could we put something about Trump in it?
God.
And I was like, listen, this is a movie that you're going to watch in 10 years as well. Yeah, if we put Trump in it and the election last year, no one's going to watch it in 10 years. So I think that we went against all the speculations and all the clever thoughts of the networks, and we proved them 100% wrong, because it has been watched by 2 million people on YouTube in just a few months, I think in 3 months or so. It has had more than 35,000 positive likes. It's had more than 15,000 comments. And imagine how many millions and millions and millions of minutes it's been streamed.
Yeah.
So it's also available on Amazon Prime Video. It's also available for free on the Roku channel in the U.S. I don't have any numbers, but, you know, people have always also been watching it there. So
YouTube, it's on YouTube.
Sorry?
It's on YouTube. I just want to get that out there.
Yeah. The thing is, with all the networks being so clever on their viewers' behalf of what they could stomach or not, what they would have an interest in or not, I just have to say, we 110% proved you wrong.
Yeah.
So Netflix, all the other big networks, take a chance. Be a bit bold. It doesn't need to be about a crime story that happened 15 years ago that we all know the outcome to. Be a bit bold with some of these stories. Go back. You can still keep all the other stuff on, which is great stuff as well. But there is a need, there is a hunger for vitamins still out there among your audience. They still want to see stories like this. And you know, if you doubt it, I've got the numbers to prove it.
Right. Absolutely.
Good for you. Well, going back to what you said, and this is what I keep thinking about. You mentioned it about you knew that was great. Movie, great exposure or great moment. How do you, as a filmmaker, capture the like true stuff as opposed to this is going to make good TV? How do you balance that?
It all needs to be good TV, and it all needs to be, you know, compelling and true. So I think that with 84 minutes coming out of 100 hours filmed or more, then you have a lot of material to choose from. I just spoke to Jason actually the other day. We're talking about doing a sequel. Nice. It's almost like I don't need to go and film him again, because I could do 10 films just from the material that we have. But I think that it is so actually difficult in many ways doing a film like this, because there is no formula saying how to do it. And you can make choices that are completely wrong. But then what is so super important is going back to being yourself, doing it as you see fit. I, in many ways, believe that if you just do whatever you do the way that you think is the right way, then it is the right way, perhaps not to 100 million viewers, but to you and then the audience that you will get. Don't go chasing necessarily a big number of viewers. Don't care about how many followers you get on Instagram, etc. But care about, be patient with, spend a lot of time thinking again and again and again about how you actually want to leave this mark of your craft and your life with whoever is going to, you know, be the audience of it. And if you do that, then I think it's going to be great. Naturally, when you do a film, there are basic stuff that you just need to be, you know, 100% sharp on. And that is, it needs to look good. It needs to be great sound. It needs to be cut in the right way. It needs to be great and all these things in the right way. And there needs to be a red line to your story from A to C. and you come prepared. I always come prepared to whatever job I'm doing, because then you also have something to fall back on if things go wrong. I think those things are basic, and it goes without saying. I was brought up the way that if the three of us, we have an appointment at 11 a.m., I'm there at 10:59.
Yeah.
But no one can tell you when you're doing a documentary, if you're doing a painting, if you're writing a song, what is the right or the wrong way to do it. But you can tell yourself what is the right way, because that is the way you want it. And I think much more film and artists, they should think about their craft that way, being themselves.
I love what you're saying. And because we get some crap from people because we have such a wide array of guests where we've never followed like the niche where you're, oh, we're just going to do comedians. We just talk to people that we find interesting. We love talking to as many different types of people from different areas as we can. And we've been told by experts in the podcast that you need to have a niche. Your guests have to all be this. Your guests have to all, and we just say, no, we want to do what we want to do. And if that means that we don't get as many views as we could, so be it. But we love having these conversations. So I really appreciate what you're saying there.
But also think that is the right way of doing it. And it also depends on what you want to achieve with your podcast. If you want to get the next big contract with Spotify and you want a million views episode, then perhaps you should do things differently. And you know, I don't know if, listen to the experts if they're right. But again, I think that in many ways, life is too short, at least when you get to our age. I think that, you know, I'm very fortunate with the way that I can do mine, my stuff, because honestly, with what I do, at times I make a ton of money from what I do. And that gives me, as I started out by saying, the possibility of doing what I do now. So I speak from a different position than people that are struggling to get through. I know we come from completely different aspects in that way, but it doesn't change the fact that if I didn't make any money, it would still make me way happier as a filmmaker or as an author doing the film, the book, the way that I see best fit. Naturally, having a ton, because, you know, before we released Face of Hate, I think that we had like 30, 40 people screening it, giving their opinions. But by the end of the day, we had to go with our gut, thinking this is the right way of doing it. Because what you also realize is when you bring in all the experts, all the producers, etc., one person will think that the color red is the right choice for you, whereas the other one will think it is the color yellow. Right. And that's why you put on a red and a yellow t-shirt today. but by the end of the day, believe and trust in yourself. Because then I think that it's also more difficult getting angry with yourself for the lack of success then, because you can explain to yourself, but I felt it was right doing it this way. It is a bit more easy getting mad at yourself if it turned out to be a failure and you listen to the guy with the red and the yellow t-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we let you go, I have a couple more questions about Jason too. that I got to ask. I'm curious, and I agree with you what you said about him meeting you definitely made a big change in his life and helped him change. But do you think if he doesn't go back to jail the second time that he's still alive? You know, to be honest, do you think he would have ended up doing something stupid?
It's difficult to say, but there's definitely a possibility of him committing a domestic terror attack, as he admits to in the film.
Right at the end, yeah.
Yeah, because I think at that time he didn't feel that he had much to live for. The relationships that he had with his ex-wives and the kids were not great at that time. And if he was angry at the world for the way that he felt he had been treated. And when he had this crazy, sick ambition of being remembered for having conducted something similar to Timothy McVeigh,
mm-hmm.
then that there is a chance that he was going to do something horrible. I don't think that he's ever going to go back, because I know people have been writing a lot of bullshit online about him being stupid, unintelligent, etc. I think that, you know, without him or me being Einstein, I think there's actually a good head on his shoulders.
Yeah.
And he knows today what is right from wrong. And I don't think, that he has come so far in escaping the hatred that he'll never go back. There's a funny thing, and I actually don't remember if it's in the movie. I don't think it is. But we did an interview where he said something like, do you actually know how hard it is getting out of bed every morning, having to be angry and hateful? So think about that for a moment, that there are actually people out there that have trained their minds for years and years and years to get out of bed in the morning, being hateful, angry, violent, because they don't know anything else. But if you ask them, I am sure that not 99 out of 100, but 100 out of 100 would say, if we had the possibility of choosing, we would definitely go with happiness and love every single morning. And that was what Jason managed to turn his life into from having lived all these decades in violence and hatred. Believe in all the bullshit, as he says himself.
Right.
Well, his cousin Red, I think, was a fantastic character too. And I was curious and I kept waiting to see where he ended up. And my biggest thing is, do you have to almost stay away from those people? I mean, he distanced himself from Blockhead, but that's his relative. I was scared for Red. I really was. And he's a fantastic story. Do you think he will ever be friends with Blockhead again?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And I don't think so. And let me modify that. I think there is a chance that he will, but I think that takes a turn on Blockhead's side as well, actually denouncing the hatred, the racism, etc. Perhaps one day, but I don't know. To my knowledge, he haven't. But but I think that needs a turnaround on his part, like the one that Jason did. I don't think that there's any chance of Jason having come this far and then starting seeing Blockhead again. I think that is a bad drug.
Yeah.
Was there any drive in Jason to try and talk to Blockhead to change him around, or he just said he's got to do it on his own?
No. We sat down, we did interviews. It's not really in the film.
Mm-hmm.
For hours, where Jason tried to persuade Blockhead of getting out of the hatred and racism as well. And where he tried, you know, to talk him out of, because he was going away to prison at that time, Blockhead. And he was trying to, you know, talk him out of joining the Aryan Brotherhood once he entered the prison. And that really didn't, you know, Blockhead didn't catch on to that. So, unfortunately. So I think that there's no way that the two of them can sit down again, being friends, without Blockhead being 100% out of it. And if Jason does, then, you know, I would really fear for him going back environment again. But it's sad, because, you know, I am sure that with a guy like Blockhead,
there's something great and good inside of him as well. When you meet these guys, they're actually, you know, really friendly and you know, you can have laughs with them, though it sounds wrong to say on camera, but you can. You can discuss things with them that the three of us would discuss if we were sitting at a bar.
Right.
And I think that there's something really good inside of Blockhead as well, just as we've proven that there is inside of Jason and Red. Remember, Red has spent most of his life in prison.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as he tells in the film, that he even, you know, did more or less hitman jobs for the white supremacy movement and extremely violent. And he says in the film, there was not a single day where he was not in his cell thinking about how he could get out of it and murdering someone. And he's 100% out of it again after he found love and had a son. So it's just a question of people living life, that they get the opportunity of seeing something good, feeling something good, and doing something good. And if Blockhead had that opportunity, I'm sure he'd get out of it as well. He may strongly disagree with me if he would ever hear and see this. That doesn't mean that he wouldn't agree with me a year, 5 years,
right,
or 2 years from now.
Everybody's on their own path, right? And you don't know when it's gonna click.
But I think it's the core of us as human beings that there are good stuff in us and that we want to do good, be good, and be loved and love. But to all of us, at times, life takes turns where it's easier. Also for the three of us, being aggressive or angry or you know, screaming and shouting more than whistling.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Obviously, you had a big impact on Jason's life. What's the biggest impact Jason had on your life?
He just gives me, you know, thinking about the way that he has turned his life around, seeing that it is possible.
Yeah.
It brings a lot of, you know, joy and happiness to me. And I also, as you ask me now, I'm actually also a bit proud of myself that I have become friends with a person that horrible and despicable as Jason was, finding out that, you know, as long as he stays on the path that he is on now, I'm proud to call him my friend.
Yeah, and you should be.
Yeah, and I'm proud that, you know, somehow I found acceptance for him, because it's so easy being judgmental also towards these people, because I guess that most people can see and say that being a racist and being, you know, violent, brutalizing innocent people is absolutely wrong. But what if we just stick around for another 30 seconds? Could that horrible person then also become a friend if you give them a chance of becoming so and doing better? So I think that is one thing that has taken, you know, that I'm so proud of my relationship with Jason and doing this film. And then I'm also, you know, super proud that so many people have seen it. Yeah. And
well, I think a huge part is from his perspective, which I can't obviously speak for him, but you didn't give up on him. And right. I think that went a long way with him.
Yeah.
And I think that I respected him. I treated him with respect.
True.
And I think that is important. I would also do that with the opposite of Jason or whoever it may be. When you go out there as a journalist, you need to be respectful. Also, when you interview people who have opinions and beliefs that you as a person yourself find despicable, then at the time and moment where you interview them, you still need to be respectful. You're not there to judge them. You're there to listen and be naturally also critical towards them. But you're not there to tell them if they're right or wrong. You can do that through your questions, but treat them with respect.
And the same thing goes. If you walk into the office of a CEO or prime minister or whoever it may be, or the home of a celebrity, you treat them with respect, but you don't treat them as gods or kings. Not even the king. You don't even treat the king, in my opinion, differently than anyone else.
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. by the end of the day, we're all human beings. No one has more rights to the truth for being here than the other. So I think that it's important, you know, as a journalist, you know, just be the person to the other that you feel that they deserve, you know, when they let you into their home, into their home.
Absolutely.
That is great. And sorry to say, that is also, you know, what I find so actually saddening when I watch a lot of the big news networks in the U.S., regardless if it's Fox or CNN. It has nothing to do with journalism these days. It is opinion making.
Yep.
And that is fine. And as I said, it goes for both CNN and Fox and all the others.
Absolutely.
Then just call it journalism. Don't call it journalism. Because journalism is way too important and necessary in this world to be having its great reputation ruined by people claiming to be journalists but being opinion makers.
Right. Well, that's why there's such a big push for independent journalism on you know, online, and that's where more and more people are getting their information from, and less people are watching CNN and Fox and all that stuff. I mean, there's a reason for all of that. So
huge. That's huge. Yeah. So what I'm really, really, really curious about is you got a lot of deep, dark subjects that you deal with your documentaries. What do you do to have fun outside of filming to make yourself, not that journalism doesn't make you happy, but to make you happy?
It cut up a bit with the last 10 seconds of the question.
What do you, with all the dark subjects matter that you deal with, what do you do in your personal time to make yourself happy and it just some hobbies that you enjoy?
I spend time with my kids.
Yeah.
That makes me happy.
Yeah.
I, you know, truly enjoy right now. My daughter is 13 years old.
Fun.
So naturally, I let her watch Dexter with me. And there are 8 seasons, so we just started that. I watch, you know, I go for long walks with her. Every morning, I bring her to school, and it's like half an hour walk. And I pick her up from school, it's half an hour walk. We hold hands. We talk about, you know, nothing, you know, we're not like, or at least the dad is not a highly intellectual guy who talks about important matters. I talk about what I've been doing. I talk about these two great podcasters that I did, you know, an interview with, one wearing a red and the other a yellow t-shirt. You know, little things in life, but it just, you know, makes me happy. Having the possibility of walking her to school every morning, picking her up. I love going to soccer practice with Benjamin, who's 7 years old, and, you know, just having to feel like, oh, I want to run in there and get the ball instead of letting you kids have it. These small things. I walk a lot. I think that yesterday, I just looked up on my phone, I think that I walked 12 miles around London.
Jesus.
looking at people. I was sitting in the cocktail bar here at the hotel where I'm at last night. I don't drink alcohol. So I just enjoyed sitting there for like 4 hours watching people get more and more drunk. and if you do drink alcohol, be a bit careful about how you act next time you come out. At least one of us who doesn't drink. But I also, you know, enjoy, and I think that is something that, especially being a dad to a teenager, I also enjoy the fact that when I sat at that cocktail bar last night, I didn't feel that I had to. I felt like I wanted to put my phone away. You know, we're all sitting there, also grown up. I was just, you know, putting it down, didn't even want to pick it up. I'd rather look at people. So it's the little things that make me happy. I was going through a time that was hard on me mentally. I wrote a book called Moms of the Missing, Living the Nightmare, where I interviewed 10 American moms who've had their children taken by everything from serial killers to pedophiles, etc. Many of them, they don't know where the kids are now. Now, imagine having your kid taken that you love. I don't know if the two of you are fathers.
We are.
But both are, yes.
Imagine having one of your kids, perhaps even at the age of 9, 10 taken, and you don't know what happened to him. Imagine what that would do to your life. So when I wrote that book, and it came out in 2019, and when I wrote that book, and it was like haunting me constantly, also being a father myself, but it was very difficult having done interviews with these ladies and many others, and then just putting it down and going to bed. But what worked for me was that I started training very much a martial art called Krav Maga. And you know, you get obsessive with things. So I think that I was even at a time training 4 or 5 times a week. So that helped. Other times, it's been running, being physical, doing stuff like that, that gets it out of your head, right? Because it needs to come out. But with age, you probably also get a bit more cynical in many ways, because you need to put this stuff away. When I wrote my first book, or not my first book, but the first book that came out in the U.S., it was called The Deprived, Innocent on Death Row. It was a book that debated the use of the capital punishment. And I got a lot of death threats when that came out, in many ways. I still do also with Face of Hate.
Wow. It's crazy.
Yeah. But today it doesn't touch me. It did back then, just 6, 7 years ago. I was like, whoa. But today it's...
At the 7 years ago, did that ever make you want to not do another subject matter because you're worried about it? Or did you say, fuck it and keep going on?
I live in Denmark. Who's going to get up on a plane to kick my ass? Well,
now that I know you're doing Krav Maga 4 to 5 times a week, nobody.
Right.
But I felt the way, but it's also because it's America. You know, when I'm in the U.S. and especially with these people, I know that there's always a gun around.
And USA has got a lot of laptop warriors where they're just making threats and they'll never fucking leave their basement. So,
but my example is when Face of Hate had its premiere in a theater in Howell, Michigan, where it was filmed, a group of neo-Nazis tried to disturb, and they did a manifestation outside. Outside the theater, and there was a confrontation between some moviegoers and these neo-Nazis.
Okay.
So at that time, I wasn't there myself. I was supposed to be, but ended up for good reasons not traveling. But at that time, I was glad that I wasn't there, because things can easily get to the most extreme point in a situation like that. Also with guns around and stuff like that. So in that way, you know, I'm thinking it's not worth it. Had it been 15 years ago, I would have ran towards it. But in that way, I've changed my ways. But it today, it really doesn't affect me in that way. And it shouldn't, because, you know, if you're getting affected by that, then you can't do what I do,
right,
and what I'm meant to do.
That's crazy. I didn't know about the premiere. That would have been quite the premiere to attend, right? I would imagine Jason was at the premiere.
He is, and I got to say that he is a super bold man with a lot of courage and big balls, because he showed up a few days before the premiere. These neo-Nazi guys, they actually over a bridge at the highway pulled out a big banner saying, welcome to KKK land. This is Trump's America, I think it said. And so they knew that something was going on. They expected these protesters to, and they were. And Jason, he showed up. First of all, when you've seen Jason, it's not because, you know, he's big. I think he's the same height as I. Mm-hmm. I'm only 5'8". I think he might be 5'9". So he's not, you know, a big guy. But when you see him, I might be 6'5". I don't want to fuck with that dude. So, you know, he has a presence, as you also see in the documentary, where he can take up. But still,
he's got confidence, that's for sure. He had confidence before when he was, you know, in within that, and he has confidence today. So that's that, you're right.
But you know, really a now sound like a youngster, but a big shout out to Jason in the way that he shows up. Mm-hmm. And not only that he shows up, but when you've seen the documentary and only see the bad side of him, and you sit in front of him in a theater, then I don't think that anyone would sit there and admiring Jason. He would be the black sheep walking into that place. Still, he did.
Yeah.
Explain what he did, who he was, and how he has changed. And he did the same thing at another movie premiere in some other place, at a documentary festival in Michigan as well. And I think that outrageous of him showing up on that. And a lot of, you know, respect to him for doing that. And I hope that my hopes for this film is, now we've reached 2 million views on YouTube.
And counting.
I'm sure we'll also get to 3 million there. Yeah. Hopefully more. And I hope that it will really make it also much wider in the U.S., the film. And I don't think it has happened, but I think that one day, you know, the University of Michigan will call Jason, ask him to come and give a speech.
Sure.
I hope that the local church where he lives, one day will call him, asking him to come and give a speech. Because I think it's so remarkable what he has done. Now I'm being a bit naughty, but I know that you guys like it that way.
We do, yes.
So 20 years ago, a reporter from the New York Times came to an auction in Howell, Michigan, where Jason had just purchased a photograph of a burning cross that is also in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Times did an interview with Jason talking about how this place was still haunted by the KKK and now portrayed by Jason, because back then he also stood up for his beliefs.
Sure.
So being a journalist myself, I thought it was really clever getting in touch with the journalist that is still working at the New York Times. I think he actually just won a Pulitzer.
Okay.
But I got in touch with him, said, this is where we are. Why don't you go and actually interview Jason today?
Yeah.
Or he's just a call. Because
Follow
you know
up.
What?
Yeah.
It's great journalism.
Yeah.
Right.
How the world develops, and we people as well. And I actually wrote that guy a couple of times, and I couldn't help because, you know, I don't think that there's any of his, you know, articles that has lately gotten 2 million read. So, you know.
Right.
Send him another email. You know, now we've reached 2 million views just on YouTube alone, not including Prime and Roku. Don't you think it's about time that you actually, you know, do something with Jason?
Right.
So I think that there's a lot to learn from this film. And I think that the people who are there to describe the bad also should be there to describe the good.
100%, yeah.
The reason why Face of Hate has become such a huge success is it's a film about evil and darkness that turns into a beautiful love story, full of hope and redemption.
Yeah.
And that is what people, they need. So many people have reached out to me. You can see the comments on YouTube and everywhere else. People, they can see themselves. They identify with the film. If it's because they're recovering from drug use, alcoholism, a bad divorce, if they're getting out of hatred themselves, it shows that even the worst can change for the better. And I think that is also what is needed in journalism today, that we're not only there for the rally and the protests, but we're also there for the day after when people, they regret, and when they act upon that regret, turning their lives into something better. That is really my hope, that this film gets much wider out. And I hope that there are some of the network executives who said that they didn't believe in this film, that their viewers were going to watch it. And then we can prove them wrong with millions and millions and millions. Please let me repeat myself. Millions and millions and millions being watched. Because have confidence in your audience. They're much, much more clever than you give them credit for.
Oh, you hit it on the head. You really did. And I got to say, our respect for you, for your independent journalism, is unbelievable. Bring it.
Thank
you. I'm sorry. I just appreciate what you've done. And I'm tearing up because of what I'm thinking back on the story. And just back to the New York person, he doesn't want to do the follow-up, it sounds like. He just wants, like you said, the riots. You know what? Go with the good stuff. The good stuff is where we need more in this world. And thank you so much. Thank you.
And you know what? Thank you for your kind words. But also think that, you know, with 2 million views just now, I feel that I'm also in a position to say, do the right thing. Go interview Jason. And right. Not only, you know, necessarily Jason. Why would I want him to do the interview with Jason? Because I think that with the remarkable turnaround and the good that Jason has done, he needs to be in New York Times now.
Right.
For you know, not now being a neo-Nazi, buying a stupid, despicable picture. He needs to be there now. So he actually, you know, shed a light in the darkness for other people who are doubting if they can turn their life around. But also because basically journalism needs to portray the bad and all the terrifying things in this world, because that is how the public become aware of a problem. That is actually by describing that problem. But it's a big mistake because no one, no viewers, no listeners, no readers today only wants to be left with the bad news. They also want to see the solution that came out of it a year and years later. And that is what matters in journalism today. On a personal note, I heavily advise people when they go online, regardless where it is that they get the news. When you see the headline, 10 people brutally attacked or 10 people died in this or that, don't read it. Too many stories about that today and you get flooded with it and it won't do you any good reading that stuff. But there are stuff about invasion of other countries, about what is going on in Gaza. What is going on, you know, perhaps with the school system, something as boring as that in your local community that you need from a democratic point of view to read.
Yeah.
It is necessary. We don't need to read or hear about all the other crap because it doesn't do us any good. Naturally, yeah, we need to be aware of crime rates coming up, blah, blah, blah. But you don't need to sit and watch, read 10 stories about rape, murders, etc. every day. It doesn't do it good. But it is like journalism has forgotten to do the opposite. And that is the constructive and positive news that is needed, because that is also something that fills us with belief that it actually matters.
Yeah.
There can hope. We need hope. We need a lot of hope.
We do. We do. Especially at these times. And I think that is why Face of Hate is such a huge success. And I think that is why these networks also need to do more journalism, filmmaking like this, and the big newspaper papers need to get off their horse and realize that they don't write pieces for the experts, but for the people that are actually buying and paying for the newspapers.
Right.
Down on you know, solid ground.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks for the words. Yes,
I was going to say, I want to echo what he said without the tears. We really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. And we would, if the next time you're in touch with Jason, please send him our best. Tell him that you know, he's got people out there who think positively of him. I'm sure that
today,
the amount of death threats that you get, he's probably gets even more than that because he's getting it from both sides. So thank you very much for putting out the movie. I hope everybody goes out and watches it.
Yes.
And thank you very much for coming on and spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. This is a lot of fun.
Anytime. We've only been talking for 1 hour and 40 minutes. I expect us to continue at least for another 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah. All right. Don't you have some walking to do?
I love your sense of humor. I do.
I do.
You've thrown it out there every so often, and it's been great.
Well, thank you very much. Tell everybody where to find you and what's coming up next and all that good stuff.
Where they can find me. If they come with open arms, they can find me in Copenhagen, Denmark. Otherwise, stay at home. No, if they want to, you know, first of all, go to YouTube, watch the film. Don't go to Prime because they'll charge you and I'll make money off you. We don't want that to happen. Go to YouTube. And you know, if you want to, you know, see photos of what I had for lunch, then follow me on Instagram. But that is basically where I am. So the only thing I'd like to share about that is that I'm actually also finishing a book on based on Face of Hate.
Okay.
Which is more about my personal experience.
Oh, cool.
The movie is naturally very much as it should be about Jason, but I hope to, you know, within the next half year, finish the book about, you know, how I saw and felt this environment. And that is something that, going back to your question, that gives me joy. Is actually writing, as it does. But, you know, just writing my books and stuff, writing them for myself the way that I want to, I love it.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm going to, I don't want to say leave with your motto, but I by talking to you for the last hour and a half, I truly believe you now with your motto that I've read on your website. And if they give you ruled paper, write the other way. I truly believe it now that I've talked to you. It's a great motto.
Thank you. I hope that's a good thing.
Awesome thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you got the book coming out, if you want to come back and promote the book, anytime you want to promote anything, you let us know. This was fantastic and we love it.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Have a good time in London.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much and thank you very much, guys. And I love the format that you do for your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
You guys. I actually like that you've set up the studio as you have. Normally, when you do a lot of podcasts, you're being interviewed by a host with the mic, you know, in front of his face. And you have this dude, old as the three of us, sitting there in front of his computer. And it looks like he's gaming. I think that, you know, the way that you guys set it up, it's great. And I think that you've got great guests. And the last thing is, I kept my shirt on, but I deeply admired your previous guest with the episode that you just put out the other day with this musician. It was like in the beginning, I was thinking, Oh my, is that Ricky Martin that you've got on, or Enrique Bishop? Because his shirt was like downhill.
It was.
That was great. I love that you have a lot of different interesting characters.
Yeah.
Well, that's great to hear, because that's like he mentioned, that's what we want. We enjoy. We want to talk to you.
Thank you for the kind words. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You guys, take care.
All right.
Yeah, you too.
Good night.
Thank you for listening. The tavern is closed for now, but we'd love to have you back for more fun next time. Seriously, though, get your asses out of here.
Do you have any favorite memories of the first season of Nevermind the Music?
I do. I love the time that we realized that I have perfect pitch.
You mean when we realized you don't have perfect pitch?
I don't know, dude. I'd love to see you prove me wrong.
I've got a piano right there.
This is the second season of Nevermind the Music,
where one psychologist finds out she's really good at music.
And one songwriter finds out he's really good at cognitive biases.
This season, we talk music and the mind, one iconic song at a time.
From the key changes in Metallica
to the neurotransmitters in Mariah.
And can we finally talk about Taylor?
They're just going to have to listen to Nevermind the Music
wherever you get your podcasts.